He has been slow in coming forward with a lot of work in this area. But our guest this morning is an exception to that rule. Robert E. Gilbert, from 1978 to 1990, was chairman of the Department of Political Science at Northeastern University. He's escaped from that onerous task only since September. He was born in New York. He got his bachelor's and master's degree from Fordham and his PhD from the University of Massachusetts. He's taught at a number of institutions, Boston College, University of Wisconsin. He's been a consultant to various publishing houses, John Wiley, McGraw-Hill, Holbrook. He's been director of the Spring Hill Corporation. He's the author of a major work entitled Television and Presidential Politics. He's written a series of quite significant papers on presidential disability, and they've appeared in interdisciplinary journals in a very interesting way. The one on Coolidge's health problems and illness in the journal Political Psychology, and the one on Roosevelt in a journal Politics and the Life Sciences. He's currently working on another study of Eisenhower. Recently, he gave a paper at the annual meeting of the Political Science Association in San Francisco, which attracted considerable attention and discussion. The paper is close to the subject that he'll be addressing today, Presidential Disability, the Case of John F. Kennedy, He's received many awards as for his teaching and for his research, and we feel privileged that he would join us to set the record straight on Ken Crispell's conclusions in this magnificent work.
I hope you care better than I care.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me to be here at the Miller Center and to be visiting the University of Virginia. This is the first time I've had an opportunity to visit this beautiful campus. I was telling Dr. Thompson I come from a campus that's in the middle of Boston, and we can count the trees, we can count the flowers, and so to see so much grass and trees and flowers it's a pleasure. I am sorry that your football team didn't win the other day. When I was coming in from the airport, the cab driver asked me where I was from, and I told him I was from Boston, and he said, "I'm very, very happy that you're from Boston," he said, "because whenever I bring a fare from the airport from either Boston and Philadelphia," I don't know why those two cities, "the Virginia Cavaliers always win." So I guess that's one tradition now that has gone down the drain. Next time, bring in someone from Philadelphia. I agree with your statement that you just made, that presidential disability has received very little serious attention. The framers of the Constitution paid no attention to it at all. They dealt only with the subject of presidential death and succession by the vice president, but they didn't deal with all of those instances, and there have been many, many instances since the Constitution was written when the president was to some degree and in some way disabled. I suppose the first time the subject began to be addressed in a serious way was in 1955, when President Eisenhower suffered his first serious illness. In September of 1955, President Eisenhower suffered a moderately severe heart attack. And as a result of his illness, and he was ill until about January of that year, his Attorney General, Herbert Brownell, actually drafted a constitutional amendment. And the amendment was added to the Constitution in 1967. Brownell has indicated that the amendment was not ratified earlier because Lyndon Johnson and Sam Rayburn, who Johnson was the majority leader of the Senate and Sam Rayburn was the Speaker of the House at the time, opposed the amendment because they felt that it would unduly inflate the political power of Richard Nixon. And they were not anxious to inflate Nixon's power because obviously Johnson was considering running for president. in the near future, which he did, of course, in 1960. But the amendment was finally added to the Constitution in 1967, and we know now, even though that was an advance, even though that was an improvement in the situation, the so-called disability amendment, or the 25th Amendment to the Constitution, really hasn't resolved the question, really hasn't solved the problem of presidential disability. And I think that the reason for that is that the problem really can't be solved. It can't be completely solved because there are so many different forms and so many different degrees of disability and or inability. I would just like to mention four types of presidential disability as a lead-in to a discussion of President Kennedy. First of all, there would be psychological disability. Secondly, there would be physical disability that resulted from a president's being unconscious. Thirdly, there would be physical disability resulting from a president suffering a serious illness which impairs his ability to function to some degree, either in part or completely. And lastly, would be cases of inability or disability that resulted not from an illness on the part of the president, but rather from the impact of the medication that the president is taking to control the illness. In other words, the illness is under control, but the medication that the president is taking affects his judgment, affects his political behavior. And this, of course, might also result in a constitutional crisis that the 25th Amendment really hasn't resolved. If I could just say a few words about these four types of disability. First of all, psychological disability. This might be the most difficult of all to gauge and the most difficult of all to deal with. I think Calvin Coolidge is a good example of a president who really was experiencing psychological disability, although very few people knew it at the time, and although it would be very, very difficult to prove at the time. As a matter of fact, it would have produced a constitutional crisis if the vice president at the time had indicated that the president was not functioning because of a psychological impairment. But psychological difficulties springing from the death of his 16-year-old son in the summer of 1924 completely immobilized Calvin Coolidge. Coolidge never recovered. You know, we think of Calvin Coolidge as being a very passive president, being a very quiet president, not saying much, not doing much. He was Ronald Reagan's favorite president. And when Ronald Reagan became president, he had Coolidge's picture hung in the Oval Office in a place of honor, and he wanted to pattern his behavior on the behavior of Calvin Coolidge. But Calvin Coolidge was not a passive politician. Calvin Coolidge had a long, distinguished career. He was governor of Massachusetts. He was president of the state senate in Massachusetts. And during all of his previous political career, and even after his first year, or during his first year as president of the United States after Harding's sudden death, Coolidge was a hard-working president. He was affiliated with the progressive wing of the Republican Party, not the conservative wing of the Republican Party. Remember, Ronald Reagan wanted to do away with the Department of Education. It was Calvin Coolidge that first suggested that we have a Department of Education. He was allied with the progressive wing of the Republican Party, hardworking. His admonition when he was president of the Senate in one succinct line was, do the day's work. He worked hard. He was at his desk, even as vice president of the United States. He was a hard-working vice president. Officials in the Capitol said that he was an unusual vice president because he worked so hard. In 1924, at the moment he was nominated in his own right by the Republican Party for a term as president of the United States, his 16-year-old son died, Coolidge went into a depression from which he never recovered. He began to sleep 14 hours a day, take naps, even on top of the long periods of sleep. Obviously, he was trying to escape. He blamed himself for his son's death. And could never recover. He said in his autobiography, when my boy died, the power and glory of the presidency went with him. Lost interest in the job. And of course, for the next 4 years, his administration was immobilized. He told his cabinet, you do what you've been hired to do. I don't want to deal with anything. If there's a problem in foreign policy, let the Secretary of State deal with it. There was a problem in the Labor Department when Coolidge was president. Coolidge said to his Secretary of Labor, that's why I hired you. If you can't handle it, I'll get a new Secretary of Labor. Don't bother me. Psychological impairment. The administration came to a standstill because of it. Second type of presidential disability, physical disability resulting from the president becoming comatose or unconscious. This has been dealt with pretty effectively, I think, by the 25th Amendment. And three of our last seven presidents have been unconscious because of illness, because of surgeries. President Reagan, under anesthesia for 5 hours during his cancer operation in 1985. President Eisenhower, under anesthesia for 3 hours in 1956 when he underwent an ileitis operation. President Johnson, anesthetized for a period of time during which he had a gallbladder operation. These are periods of time when the president obviously was out of touch, couldn't function. The 25th Amendment presumably has filled the gap here, because now it is constitutional for the president to alert his vice president and tell his vice president that for all intents and purposes he had become acting president while the president was under this anesthesia. And I might add here that until 1967, presidents like Eisenhower and Kennedy and Johnson had an informal relationship or an informal arrangement with their vice president. You know, they each had sent a letter to their vice president saying that at certain times, as for example when I'm under anesthesia, you will become acting president. But there are people who believe that that was unconstitutional, that the Constitution doesn't provide or didn't provide at that time for a method of a president passing on his powers to the vice president constitutionally, and therefore a letter wouldn't suffice, that it could be challenged. As of 1967, of course, it can no longer be challenged. A third type of presidential disability is when the president is disabled because of a severe illness. And obviously, the impairment can be substantial. And we've had a number of instances of this. President Garfield incapacitated for 6 months after he was shot by an assassin. He didn't die for a period of 6 months. And during that period of time, basically, he wasn't functioning. President William Henry Harrison, who became ill on the day of his inauguration and who only lived 1 month as president and who had pneumonia during that period of time. Obviously, Harrison wasn't functioning. Woodrow Wilson, who suffered a stroke and was incapacitated for more than a year, badly incapacitated for more than a year. And Franklin Roosevelt, who also was ill, not incapacitated to the degree that Woodrow Wilson or James Garfield was incapacitated, but certainly was impaired. Franklin Roosevelt, as you know, was president longer than anyone else in American history. And unless the 22nd Amendment is repealed, no other person will ever serve as long as Franklin Roosevelt. He was elected, as you know, four times. In his second administration, some of his cabinet members began to think that they detected signs of poor health. By 1941, the signs of ill health were verified by doctors, and they found that his blood pressure was very, very erratic, would become very, very high, and then would plummet, then would become high, then would plummet, and so on and so forth. In 1944, before he ran for a fourth term, doctors found that he had a grossly enlarged heart, congestive heart failure, and that he suffered from such severe stomach pains that rumors circulated from time to time that he had been poisoned, that attempts had been made to assassinate him. Doctors were so concerned about his Roosevelt's poor health that they advised that he work no longer than 4 hours a day. This is before he ran for his fourth term, 4 hours a day. This is an advice that Roosevelt didn't follow. He continued to work as he had worked before, but this was the medical advice that the doctors gave him. Obviously, they were concerned about his health if they suggested that he only work 4 hours a day. It was also in 1944, and as you know, he died soon after this, that Roosevelt was noticed by his secretaries, by his aides, to seemingly doze off at meetings. While he would be dictating to his secretary, he would seemingly doze off and then would wake up again with a start. This was also seen at the Yalta Conference, where Roosevelt would seem to fall asleep and then wake up again with a start. He wasn't really falling asleep. What was involved here was a lack of oxygen to his brain, an uneven flow of oxygen to his brain that would cause this physical reaction. As a matter of fact, there's a very interesting study that was done of Franklin Roosevelt's handwriting during the Yalta conference, samples of his handwriting. And his handwriting varied on the same day, not just from day to day, but his handwriting would be different at different times during the day. And the differences are enormous. His handwriting would be small, then his handwriting would be large. And this has been attributed to, again, an uneven flow of oxygen to his brain that affected the way he wrote, that affected the way he carried himself at the Yalta conference. And so I think his performance there was impaired. I don't think it was destroyed, as in the case of Woodrow Wilson, who was completely incapacitated. If Roosevelt had lived beyond 1945, if he had continued into 46 and 47 and 48, I think the impairment would have gotten more and more serious. But of course, he died suddenly in 1945. And the final category of presidential disability, and the one that I'd like to look at in more detail today, is one in which the president is ill, his illnesses are under control, but the medication that the president uses might have an impact on his political behavior, might shape his political judgments, and so on and so forth. And in this latter category, I would place a President Kennedy, at least a President Kennedy with a question mark after his name. I think it's ironic, sort of one of the cruel ironies of American history, that the president who is credited with the physical fitness craze that swept the country, the joggers and the hikers and so on and so forth, and the president who became famous for using the word vigor, that the symbol of that presidency is a rocking chair. And this rocking chair is on display at the Kennedy Library in Boston. The president who talked so much about movement and motion in his campaign, talking about, I want to get the country moving again, was a president who found it very difficult to move because of his physical disabilities. John Kennedy, I think, looking back at his childhood, looking back at his early career, his teenage years and so on, was a very unlikely candidate for the presidency, very unlikely prospect for the presidency. And I would imagine if you could go back to 1917 when he was born, and 1918 and 1919 in those early years, and were to tell his parents that this man would become president of the United States and would be a charismatic figure who would excite millions and millions of people when he traveled and so on and so forth, I think his parents would have been very surprised. His mother described John Kennedy in her autobiography as, quote, a frail little boy, a frail little boy. In addition to the ordinary childhood illnesses of measles, chickenpox, bronchitis, whooping cough, and German measles, John Kennedy almost died from scarlet fever when he was 3. He suffered from diphtheria. He had a weak stomach. He had an irritable colon, which made it difficult for him to eat. He suffered from asthma, which gave him enormous difficulty. He suffered from allergies, which affected him until the day he died. This is something that has not really been reported in the news, but the walls of the White House used to have to be scrubbed, washed down. The elevators used to have to be scrubbed down to try to prevent dust or the hair of a dog, for example, if someone brought a dog into the White House. Kennedy could have an allergic reaction that would be devastating to him. In fact, when he was in the Senate, he almost died of an allergic reaction. One of the great concerns of the State Department when Kennedy went on foreign trips was when he had to stay in a foreign embassy. Would the foreign embassy be as clean of the dust and the things that Kennedy was allergic to? It was an ongoing problem. So difficult range of diseases. In his early teen years, his eyesight began to fail. He needed glasses. We saw very few pictures of him wearing glasses, but he needed glasses from his early years. He suffered from dizzy spells. He underwent an appendicitis operation. He had his tonsils and his adenoids removed, and he developed a severe case of pneumonia that required hospitalization. In his late teen years, when he entered the London School of Economics, he developed a case of hepatitis that was so bad he had to withdraw from school. He had to return to the United States. He entered Princeton University, and he deliberately went to Princeton because Princeton is close to New York. and the doctors who were treating him were located in New York. When he began studies at Princeton, the hepatitis recurred, and he had to, again, drop out of school, spend 2 months in the hospital, and then move to Arizona, where he had to spend many months recuperating. You know, Kennedy is famous for having gone to Harvard. Harvard was his third choice. He didn't want to go to Harvard. He finally ended up in Harvard, where he would be closer to his family because of his illnesses. During the war years, he's famous for the sinking of his PT boat, which I'll talk about in a few minutes because it did have a bearing on one of the serious ailments that affected him all his life. But after the war, Kennedy came down with malaria and sciatica, and one of his aides described his sciatica condition as one that caused him agony, and this was when he was in his 20s. As a matter of fact, this was shortly before he ran for the House of Representatives in 1946. Kennedy had two serious long-term ailments that were with him through much of his life. One was a bad back, and the other was Addison's disease. The bad back, let me say a few words about each of them. They're in a way interrelated because I think the Addison's disease had made the bad back even more acute, the problems of the bad back even more acute. But with regard to his bad back, and this is an ailment for which, of course, Kennedy was famous, the Addison's disease was concealed for a long period of time. His doctors and Kennedy himself denied that he had Addison's disease. But in terms of his bad back, this was a very famous ailment that he had. Kennedy was born with one side of his body smaller than the other, and this was not diagnosed until the 1950s. His left shoulder was lower than his right shoulder, and his left leg was about a half an inch, roughly a half an inch shorter than his right leg. And what this produced, this skeletal malformation, what this produced was when he walked, it would, and again, he didn't realize this, and his doctors didn't realize this, it would create pressure on his spine that eventually, year after year after year, caused tremendous pain, tremendous back pain. That was really unrelieved by any of the steps that Kennedy took to relieve it, really unrelieved. It was only in the last 5 or 6 years of his life that his back pain was controlled, not corrected, but at least brought under control. So this was the root cause of his bad back, the fact that he was born with a skeletal malformation. The problem, however, was compounded by a number of factors. One of the factors was he suffered from thyroid insufficiency, another physical ailment that was detected in him, thyroid insufficiency and Addison's disease, and both of these ailments have been found to produce muscular spasms. And in Kennedy's case, the spasms tended to occur in his back. So the back that was already weakened because of the malformation was made much worse by these two other physical conditions that caused spasming. That was intensely painful for him. Secondly, when he was a sophomore at Harvard, he was playing football, which is really surprising. Someone with a back as bad as his was shouldn't have been playing football. But he was playing football, and he was tackled, and he suffered a ruptured spinal disc, which again made the back problem that much worse. As a matter of fact, he never fully recovered from the ruptured spinal disc. His mother said this in her autobiography, this was the beginning of his back problems that lasted the rest of his life. Well, it wasn't really the beginning, but it certainly did make them more acute. And thirdly, when a ship was rammed and sunk by a Japanese destroyer during World War II, Kennedy was thrown off his feet. He again ruptured another spinal disc. He was forced to spend many hours in the water, swimming, trying to save the life of one of his shipmates, and this caused, again, additional strain on his bad back. I would add here that Kennedy was rejected for service in the Army because of his bad back, and there were rumors that he was accepted by the Navy after his father intervened, but the Army felt that his back was too weak for ordinary military service. How long would you like me to speak about?
Keep going.
I don't want to go too far here. In 1944, Navy doctors performed a lumbar disc operation on Kennedy, trying to alleviate the pressure on his nerve endings in his back, thinking that this would alleviate the pain. But the operation didn't work, and his pain got worse. I think it's ironic. This was, by the way, 2 years before he ran for the House of Representatives. So what this means, of course, is at the time when he was in agony with his bad back, having just undergone an unsuccessful back surgery, Kennedy decided at that point, and he was only in his 20s, at that point, to enter political life. He ran for a seat in the Massachusetts delegation for the House of Representatives, the U.S. House of Representatives. It was a hard-fought campaign. He had, I think, 11 opponents for the nomination. He fought through the primary, he fought through the general election campaign, and he was elected in 1946 at the age of only 29. And this is right after the back surgeries and in the face of the severe back pain that he was still experiencing. Lyndon Johnson, after Kennedy's death, Lyndon Johnson was interviewed one time, and the interviewer said to him, Johnson also was a congressman at that time, but he was in the House for a number of years before Kennedy was elected. And the interviewer said to Johnson, did you remember John Kennedy when he was a new congressman, when he was a freshman congressman? Do you have any recollections? And he thought for a minute, and he said, yes, he said, I do. He said, I remember. He said, what I remember about John Kennedy when he was elected in 1946 is that Sam Rayburn was Speaker of the House and also from Texas. Sam Rayburn said to me one time, you know, that new congressman from Massachusetts, that Kennedy from Massachusetts, he's so pale and he's so thin, he's so emaciated, and his skin is such a funny color, which I'll get to in a minute, that I think he's going to die. This was the recollection of the Speaker of the House on the time that Kennedy first entered the House in 1946. In 1952, when Kennedy decided to run for the Senate, he was only 35 years of age, so he was a very, very urgent political career, trying to move up as rapidly as possible. He took on a venerable Republican, Henry Cabot Lodge, in Massachusetts, and he defeated him. But what has not gotten a great deal of attention is that when Kennedy was campaigning in 1952, he was on crutches. Now, he didn't use his crutches when he was in public. When he was in public, he would bear the pain. But in private, whenever the cameras weren't there, whenever the press wasn't there, Kennedy was on crutches. Kennedy couldn't get around. But at the very time when his back pain was becoming so severe that he was forced to use crutches, he decided to run a statewide campaign and campaign across the state of Massachusetts and to try to be elected to the United States Senate. 2 years later, Kennedy was unable to walk at all. He was consigned to crutches, the use of crutches. And as a matter of fact, he was so incapacitated by 1954 that he had to use his office in his desk in the Senate chamber. He couldn't even get back to his office in the United States Senate office building. His secretary used to come and sit next to him at his desk in the Senate, and he used to dictate there because he couldn't get back to his office. It was too difficult for him. And so he used to just work through the day sitting at his desk in the United States Senate. Obviously, Kennedy wasn't anxious to have photographers take pictures of him using his crutches. There are a couple of pictures of him on crutches in 1954, but Kennedy was very reluctant for this to happen. He thought that this would impede his political advancement for obvious reasons. In 1954, against his doctor's advice, Kennedy decided to undergo two back operations simultaneously. One was a bone graft, and one was to insert a plate into his back, which would strengthen his back. This was considered such a dangerous operation because of Kennedy's Addison's disease, and I'll talk about that in a minute, that the Leahy Clinic in Boston refused to perform the operation. They said, we think the odds of your surviving are so small that we're not even doing it. We want you to employ more conservative therapy to try to deal with it. We're not doing the operation. Kennedy instead entered the New York Hospital for Surgery in 1954, He had the operations, the two operations. His answer, by the way, to the Leahy Clinic was, "I really don't care. I can't stand the pain anymore. Has to be done. I can't keep living this way." He underwent the two operations, and he almost died. He developed a severe infection in his back. One of the things that Addison's disease does is it reduces the immune systems to infection. And he developed an infection in the wound in his back that was present for about 4 years. The doctors couldn't clear it up. Dr. Travell, who became his doctor in 1955, said he had a recurring infection in the wound in his back for about 4 years after this operation. And 3 months after the operation, he had to undergo still another operation, this time to remove the plate from his back, because the doctors thought that the plate was what was causing the infection. So he had 3 surgeries in a period of time, in a 3-month period of time. In 1955, Kennedy for the first time visited Dr. Janet Travell in New York, and Dr. Travell, of course, became one of the most famous doctors, I guess, in American history. She was the first woman to be appointed a White House physician in 1961. Dr. Travell wrote in her diary her impressions of John Kennedy when she first met him. This is when he was a senator. He was in his first term in the Senate. And this is what she wrote in her diary. Quote, "He was thin. He was ill. His nutrition was poor. He was on crutches. There were 2 steps from the street into my office, and he could hardly navigate these. His major complaint was intense pain in his left low back. He also had a right knee, which was painful. He had high cholesterol. He had thyroid insufficiency. He was really anemic, and he had neuritis." Dr. Travell helped Kennedy in a number of ways, and I guess the 2 principal ways was, first of all, she added to all of his shoes a lift, about a half-inch lift, that would equalize the length of his legs so that it would stop the seesaw motion in his bone structure when he walked. He was instructed never to go barefooted, always to wear shoes. Even in beach shoes, he had to have this lift, because she told him the pain will get worse if that seesaw motion returns. Also, she began giving him what I guess was a controversial treatment. I say I guess it was, because it did lead to some conflict among physicians in the White House in 1961. She began giving him shots of Novocaine in his back to deaden the pain. And these helped him a great deal. They didn't correct the problem, but they alleviated the symptoms. They took away the pain. They didn't make the back any better. And this is what other White House physicians, Dr. Berkeley, for example, found objectionable, that it was disguising the problem. It wasn't really getting at the root of the problem. Now, in the last 6 years of his life, Kennedy's back was better than it had been before, better with Dr. Travell's treatment. He also began, when he was president in 1961, he began a program with a New York physical therapist, a man by the name of Dr. Hans Krauss, that required Kennedy to swim a certain number of times each day in the White House pool. The pool used to be heated to 90 degrees, and Kennedy would swim in the pool. Also, he began to do a series of calisthenics that Dr. Krauss worked out for him. During the last 6 years of his life, his back was better than it had been before. Ironically, on the day that he left for Dallas, November 21st, 1963, he told his aides, quote, "I feel great. My back feels better than it has felt in years." Ironically, one of the things that made his back feel better was he began wearing various kinds of mustard plasters on his back and a brace always. Even when he would swim, he would wear a brace on his back. And there are those who believe that if he had not been wearing the brace, he might have survived the assassination attempt. Because when the first bullet struck him, it was not a fatal bullet, he would have survived it. Normally, he would have fallen over when he was shot the first time. But the brace held him in an upright position. And the second bullet, of course, killed him. The second ailment that Kennedy experienced throughout at least the last 16 years of his life was Addison's disease. In 1947, when he was a new congressman, this is the time when Addison's disease was diagnosed. There is some belief that he really had Addison's disease before 1947, but in 1947, while he was visiting in London, he became seriously ill, and a British doctor who was called to examine him said that Kennedy has Addison's disease. And as a matter of fact, he told a British friend of Kennedy, you know that young American friend of yours? And the person said yes, and he said, well, he has about a year to live because he has Addison's disease and it's going to kill him. Addison's disease involves a failure of the adrenal glands. The adrenal glands produce adrenaline and cortisone, which the body needs, and regulates the flow of minerals and salt in the body. When it was first detected as a disease, which was around 1850, it was viewed as a fatal ailment. And it was viewed as a fatal ailment until around 1940. 90% of people with Addison's disease died within a relatively short period of time. Around 1940, shortly before Kennedy came down with the disease, a new medication, which is a nickname for it, is DOCA, D-O-C-A, was developed, which reduced greatly the mortality level from the disease. Addisonians were still warned to avoid stress, and I think it's ironic that Kennedy sought the presidency, probably the most stressful office of all, because stress increases the need for certain kinds of bodily substances like cortisone that an Addisonian's adrenal glands can't produce, and therefore Addisonians are advised to avoid stress at all costs. One of the indications of Addison's disease is a discoloration of the skin. And this is something I alluded to a little while ago. A discoloration of the skin. A bronzing of the skin. If you read the books that have been written by Kennedy's aides like Sorensen and Schlesinger, famous works that have been done, they deny that Kennedy had any kind of discoloration of the skin. But in point of fact, he did. Because if you read accounts of people, his impressions of him when they met him, they all mention the same kinds of things. They all say, for example, that he struck them as being very, very tan, regardless of the time of year. Very, very tan. You know, he was famous for spending vacation periods in Cape Cod. But Cape Cod doesn't have much sun in February and January. He always seemed to be a bronzy color. As a matter of fact, a reporter one time, I guess in an unguarded moment, because Kennedy never wanted to discuss his physical ailments, never responded to questions about his physical ailments, even from friends and staff members. Kennedy was asked at one point, before he became president, why is it your skin has that unusual tinge to it, that unusual coloration? And in a moment of candor, which he never repeated again, Kennedy said to the reporter, quote, well, doctors say I've got a sort of slow motion leukemia, but they tell me I'll probably last until I'm 45. So I never worry about it until I have the shots. Okay? Discoloration of the skin. Kennedy was wholly dependent on the medication which Addisonians rely upon for survival. He took cortisone by mouth, he took cortisone by injection, and he had DOCA tablets, that medication that I mentioned a few minutes ago, implanted in his thighs, and every 3 months they would have to be changed. There are rumors that Kennedy's family kept safety deposit boxes in different cities throughout the country with this medication in it so that Kennedy would never run out, that he would have access to it no matter where he traveled. One of his own aides says that Kennedy traveled, quote, with more pills, potions, poultices and other paraphernalia than would be found in a small dispensary. Now, by 1960, at the time he launched his presidential campaign, new medications for the disease had been developed that made the adrenal problems relatively manageable. In the 1960 campaign, however, rumors circulated that Kennedy had Addison's disease, and Lyndon Johnson, or to be more accurate, Lyndon Johnson's aides, tried to use it against Kennedy. Some of Johnson's aides said, told the press that Kennedy had Addison's disease, that Kennedy was dying, that Kennedy couldn't survive. One of them, who was a Democratic National Committee woman from Texas, said, without medication, Kennedy would be dead. He won't survive 4 years as president. And of course, Kennedy responded by denying he had it, and also Kennedy's doctors denied that he had it. And if you read the statements that Kennedy's doctors issued, you can see how carefully they were worded, how very carefully they were worded. The classic cause of Addison's disease is tuberculosis. Since Kennedy never suffered from tuberculosis, he maintained he didn't have Addison's disease. He maintained that the malaria that he contracted during the war, toward the end of the war, had led to adrenal insufficiency, which was not the same thing in his thinking as Addison's disease. And his doctors used the same approach in issuing statements, that he doesn't have Addison's disease in the classic sense. In other words, hasn't been caused by tuberculosis. Drawing a very, very fine line, sort of skirting around the truth. There was a great deal of interest, I think, at the convention in the vice presidential nomination, more than usual, more than usual. There always is, as you know, as all of us know, but more than usual, because a number of leaders at the convention were convinced that Kennedy wouldn't survive 4 more years. As a matter of fact, the editor, the publisher, rather, of the Washington Post, Philip Graham, wrote a memorandum which surprisingly has not gotten much attention. Let me read you a little segment of that memorandum. And the memorandum revolves around the choice of a running mate for Kennedy in 1960. Graham wrote, and this is a direct quote from the memorandum, "I told LBJ Jack would be phoning him, and then I called Adlai Stevenson. In our prior talk, he had argued for Senator Stuart Symington on pure expediency grounds, and I had been a bit testy in pointing out that any vice president was likely to be president." Any vice president was likely to be president. This is the publisher of the Washington Post, certain that Kennedy would die of Addison's disease before his 4-year or his 8-year term came to an end. Republicans in 1960, the Nixon forces tried to use this issue against Kennedy, but of course his image of vigor and dynamism, and he radiated health. As a matter of fact, one of the curious things, in fact, I was thinking about this morning, when Kennedy and Nixon had their first debate, which was supposed to be so decisive, the visual image of the candidates was devastating to Nixon. He didn't lose the debate on the substance of the arguments. He lost it on the image that he projected, in contrast to Senator Kennedy, who was sitting a few feet away from him. Nixon, you might remember, looked very, very pale. He didn't look well. He looked sick. He looked weak. And Kennedy looked healthy and tanned. And ironically, it might have been the discoloration from the Addison's disease that gave him the color that enabled him to win this debate, which moved him in the direction of winning the 1960 election. After the election came to an end, Kennedy said to the press, quote, "I have never had Addison's disease. I have been through a long campaign, and my health is very good today." Now, of course, his doctors admit that he did have Addison's disease. Dr. Travell's papers are available at the Kennedy Library. Dr. Travell has said, yes, he did have Addison's disease. Interestingly, when she tried to discuss his Addison's disease with Kennedy himself, Kennedy denied to her that he had it. He said, "I don't have it, doctor. I just don't have it." And she changed the subject. Also, the autopsy photographs of Kennedy's body after his assassination have shown that his adrenal glands were badly atrophied and couldn't have been functioning. Okay, so these are the two ailments. Now, the final question is, what was the impact, or what is the possible impact of the medication that Kennedy was taking for these ailments? In terms of his bad back and the pain of his bad back, he didn't take painkillers. He didn't want painkillers, and he basically didn't take them. So he just withstood the pain, except, of course, the Novocaine shots after 1955. But with regard to Addison's disease, he was on heavy medication. When he became president, the amount of cortisone that he took increased. As a matter of fact, Dr. Krause, the doctor, the physical therapist I mentioned a few minutes ago, said that he found Kennedy to be taking it all the time. He said he was taking it all the time. One of the side effects of cortisone is that it causes fluid retention. And this was visible in Kennedy. Kennedy's face would appear swollen sometimes when he would be speaking, when he would have a press conference. In fact, reporters, when he entered the room, would know if he was taking cortisone, if he had taken it recently, because his face would be swollen, his neck would be swollen. On the day of his inauguration, because Kennedy was so nervous of having to give his inaugural address and so on, took so much cortisone that he wasn't able to button his shirt because his neck was so swollen because of this. Now, what are some of the other side effects of cortisone? Well, it's been found to increase, I would add here, and I really don't like to add things like this, but I think any discussion of medication would have to at least include this. Any discussion of Kennedy's medication is made much more difficult because of one other factor. And the other factor revolves around a controversial doctor that Kennedy did see. He's a New York doctor by the name of Dr. Max Jacobson. Dr. Jacobson, in the 1970s, lost his license to practice medicine in New York because he had violated drug laws, federal and state drug laws. And Dr. Jacobson treated Kennedy at least on two occasions. He admits he treated Kennedy on two occasions. He also treated Jacqueline Kennedy while they were in the White House. And Dr. Jacobson became famous for giving his patients, and some of his patients were noted celebrities like Truman Capote, for example, and he gave them injections which included amphetamines, speed, which give patients who receive it a sense of a power, an activity. Dr. Jacobson visited Kennedy in the White House. He also accompanied him during his summit trip to Vienna. And he indicates that he treated Kennedy in Vienna for an infected hand. Now, how he treated him, we'll never know. The White House obviously has said nothing about this. And the papers that would perhaps be revealing are not available at the Kennedy Library. Believe me, I've tried to get them. But he did treat Kennedy on two occasions. One occasion was before Kennedy addressed the UN. Kennedy had laryngitis. Dr. Jacobson gave him an injection in his neck, and Kennedy got his voice back. The second time that is documented was treatment for an infected hand in Vienna. Now, some authors have maintained that Kennedy's behavior in Vienna and at other points in his administration was affected by the medication that he was taking, whether it be the cortisone or whether it be the amphetamines that he may have received from Dr. Jacobson or whatever. And probably those of you who have read accounts of the Kennedy administration have come across these kinds of analyses. One author, for example, says that in Vienna, Kennedy was supercharged. He could hardly sleep. He was just so up, you know, during his meeting with Khrushchev. Others have said that at other periods in his administration, Kennedy's behavior was erratic, hyperactive, overly optimistic. It's difficult to prove or disprove this, but I would say that in terms of the work that I've done, I can't find evidence of it. I can't find evidence of it. At Vienna, the transcripts of the Vienna Summit Conference are not available. They can't be reviewed. But every account that I have seen of people who were at Vienna, who were in Vienna with Kennedy, indicate that Kennedy was very cool during the Summit Conference, that he was very calm, that he was very deliberate, that he wasn't hyperactive, that this is a myth. Also, accounts of the Cuban Missile Crisis suggest that Kennedy, again, was very, very calm, always shooting, not going as far as some of his advisors would go. You know, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, an airstrike is what we should do. And Kennedy said, no, we want a naval blockade. And his military advisor said, not strong enough, not strong enough. And Kennedy said, for me, it's strong enough. his executive committee wanted strong, aggressive action against Khrushchev. Kennedy said, give him time. Give him time. Let him have time. This doesn't suggest hyperactivity. His behavior was seemed to be very calm, very deliberate, very detached. Now, I would just conclude by asking a number of questions, and I realize the time is slipping away here. The first question is, was Kennedy ill and in pain while in the White House? And the answer is absolutely. Absolutely. He was sick and he was in pain throughout almost all of his life, right up until the moment of his death. Secondly, was he disabled because of his illnesses? And I think the answer would have to be no. He was not. As a matter of fact, his physical problems were probably better managed while he was in the White House than before, because his doctors were right there on the scene with him. Thirdly, was his political behavior modified by his medication? On the basis of available evidence, it would seem not. It would seem not. But more, of course, might be revealed when some of these transcripts do become available as time passes. And lastly, was his political behavior affected in other ways by his illnesses? And I think the answer would have to be yes. No one can be sick so long, no one can have so much pain, and not have it affect them in some way. And I think the impacts on Kennedy were clear. And I think some of them were good and some of them were bad. For example, his reputation as a member of Congress was bad. He was famous for absenteeism. He was not one of the leading members of the House and Senate. One reason why he was absent so much is because he was sick so much. When he had his back operations, he was out of commission for a year, from 1954 to 1955. Certainly it had an impact on his reputation in Congress and the absenteeism record that he created. But some impacts were more beneficial. For example, Kennedy, he had nothing in presidency. One of the best things that a president can have is a reading habit. Republican library. I never met with Kennedy when he hadn't done his homework. I don't know how he managed to do it, Clay says, and Clay's a Republican. I don't know how he managed to do it, but he was always ready, had always read everything. And this showed, of course, at press conferences. His press conferences have been rated the most effective of all the recent presidents. He would be knowledgeable, he would be able to respond effectively because of all of the material that he had assimilated through his reading. His illnesses also gave him a sense of urgency. I referred to this a few minutes ago. He ran for the House amidst great pain when he was 29. He ran for the Senate when he could hardly walk at the age of 35. He became President of the United States when he was 43 years of age, the youngest elected president in American history. You know, and this, I think, may have been caused by his fear that he was going to die, that he had to do this quickly because he wasn't going to live long. You know, Kennedy used to quote Robert Frost's poems around the country. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep, and I have promises to keep, and so on and so forth. But that was not his favorite poem. He used that in his campaign, but it wasn't his favorite poem. His favorite poem was Alan Seeger's I Have a Rendezvous with Death. This is the poem he used to quote to his friends. At Kennedy's last birthday, he was 46 years old, his aides threw a surprise birthday party for him. And at the birthday party, Kennedy said to them, I want each one of you for my birthday to sing me a song. And his aides had to think up a song to sing. And one of them sang Heart of My Heart, and one of them sang Peg of My Heart, and one of them sang Happy Days to Hear Again, the Democratic song. One of them sang Hooray for Hollywood, all happy songs. And then they said to the president, Mr. President, now you have to sing a song for us in honor of your birthday. And Kennedy thought for a long time, and the song that he sang on this happy event, where all of his aides had just sung their happy tributes, was the autumn song. It's a long, long time from May to December, and the days grow short when you reach September. These few precious days I spend with you. This is the song that Kennedy sang. Convinced that he was going to die and having to move quickly. Also, it made him interested in health issues. His interest in Medicare may have had its origins in his own physical condition. 19 days after he was inaugurated, he ordered the Public Health Service to create a child health center to deal with the problems of children who were sick. He had spent so much time as a child sick. And lastly, his illnesses seem to have given him a sense of stoicism and detachment. He could kind of stand back and look at things philosophically. in much the same way that Franklin Roosevelt did. Eleanor Roosevelt was one time asked, do you think your husband's illnesses have had an impact on him? And she said, of course. No one could go through this and not have their character shaped by it. Things can be looked at in perspective when you've suffered a great deal, like my husband did, like Franklin Roosevelt did. The same thing, I think, could be said of John Kennedy. I guess I should have said that.
Why don't we ask Dr. Chris Bell and Dr. Aldridge, who spent a lot of time in this area, to either ask a brief question or make a brief comment, amendments, additions, anything that they want to do.
But no attacks.
Well, I think that's a tremendous review. There is one point that Pat Brown knew about his illness before the convention. And actually, I think 14 days before the convention, Kennedy met with Pat Brown and said, Pat said to him, I understand you have Addison's disease, which shocked him. The reason he knew, I happen to know this because of a good friend of mine, whose wife was a candidate, and Pat had heard about the possibility of Addison's and called my friend in and said, I really want to know what's going on. So despite the fact that at least a major Democratic figure knew about it, they went ahead and elected him. He should not fear death. I would say that my friend Gene Cohen and Bob Buchanan and all that took care of him. I don't know why he feared death, because once you have treatment for Addison's disease, you're a perfectly normal human being. I have patients who are alive 30 years afterwards. So the death wish, I don't think, had anything to do with his cortisone treatment or with his Addison's disease. Maybe he just could never be reassured. I've never asked Buchanan or Cohen about this aspect of it, whether he's still... There's no question that his family feared it, and Joe had cortisone all over the country, that's for sure.
Dr. Aldridge?
Well, I don't have too much to add. You sort of divided conditions into the psychological and then the physical with unconsciousness and physical with impairment and medication. It seems to me that the psychological sort of covers all of those in a way, except perhaps the unconscious, both FDR and Wilson and probably Kennedy had psychological, not necessarily impairment, but effects secondary to their physical illnesses. And that then if you look at the sort of total picture of the psychology of the individual, granted that it's difficult to make diagnoses without having interviewed the individual, but you can wonder whether the mechanism that we call counterphobic, which is the sort of thing that makes a person who fears heights climb mountains, may have participated in Kennedy's drive to succeed. That it may have, one can wonder whether he might have been less effective had he been perfectly healthy. The same might apply to Theodore Roosevelt. And although psychological troubles are not something that presidents or presidential candidates are willing to acknowledge, they certainly do exist. There's a wide range of psychological troubles as far as their possible interference with one's fitness for high office. One would have hesitated to think that Forrestal ever would have been able to deal with high office. Eagleton, on the other hand, had obviously had troubles, but they were improved, and although they may recur, presumably the same kind of treatment would have been effective. And another time. You talk about Coolidge, though. It is, again, to use your term, ironical, he suffered from the kind of psychological illness which we consider has the best prognosis, the best future, given appropriate treatment. And yet I suspect, without, I imagine you'd know as to whether he ever, this was even suggested to him. I imagine he would have turned it down. It is sort of sad. It's also sad that at almost the same time in another country, Queen Victoria was having the same trouble as an unresolved grief reaction following Prince Albert's death. I don't think anybody knew.
There is a wonderful book that I'm sure you've read called Creativity of Illness, in which the follow-up on Knight's point is that there is something about an illness early in life. The Roosevelts, the Kennedys, and so forth. And Florence Nightingale, who went to bed right after the Boer War, this sort of thing. Amazing book.
Next question. Wilson, did you have a
I have a question that may seem impertinent. I don't mean for it to be. My question would start with, so what? Politically, what is the significance of this thorough investigation and study? And it's enormously impressive. All of the information we have, we are looking backward. Looking forward in terms of governance, what should the electorate be thinking about?
I think, can I answer?
Please.
I think that we have to look back as well as looking forward. And sometimes I think it's enough just to look back. Sometimes by looking backward, we do look forward. I think, you know, we've had 40-some-odd presidents, 41 presidents. I think each of their administrations in itself is worth looking at and understanding in itself without trying to project it into the future and without trying to derive significance or project significance into the future. And so whether it's the Wilson administration or the Lincoln administration or the Kennedy administration or whatever administration you had to be involved with, I think an understanding of it and what caused the president to do certain things that he did, what caused the president to do things or to not do things the way he did them, I think is worthy of attention. Now, having said that, I think, in a way, this does illuminate the discussion of the 25th Amendment. Because I think by looking at some of these administrations, we can come to an understanding that the 25th Amendment is not adequate, that it has not resolved these kinds of problems, many different kinds of problems. I think perhaps the authors of the 25th Amendment thought that they were pretty much, in fact, last week I was in Texas and I was on a panel with Herbert Brownell. And he's now 86 years old, but he's functioning very, very well, and his recollections are very sharp, and he's very forceful, and so on. And he seemed to think that the 25th Amendment had pretty much resolved the problem of presidential disability. And I think by looking at these various presidencies, even though they happened before the 25th Amendment was enacted, we realize, of course, that isn't the case. More work has to be done.
Please, Wilson.
But there are no specific adjustments to the 25th or other remedial actions, if indeed remedial actions are necessary. The philosophical rationalization that you've just given, I can subscribe to, but here we are probing for what significant experience and what important people, what their behavior has been, what we can learn from them, and what, if anything, would make a more responsive future.
Well, I think, again, that the 25th Amendment, if you look at the wording of the 25th Amendment, the imperfections, when you consider the Coolidge experience and the Roosevelt experience and the Kennedy experience and other experiences also, you see some problem areas, and these problem areas have been highlighted by the commission at the Miller Center. For example, the 25th Amendment doesn't involve medical involvement, doesn't require medical involvement. It's an action by the vice president and the cabinet members and then Congress. Doctors, medical professionals aren't even mentioned in this amendment. The amendment, by talking about the president, the vice president, and members of the cabinet to make this determination, the amendment is creating an extremely difficult situation, and almost an impossible situation, because the relationship between the president and vice president is so delicate to start with that to have to expect the vice president to, for example, in any of these instances, suggest that the president was disabled. Can you imagine what the reaction of the country would have been if Calvin Coolidge's vice president had said, the president is mentally incapacitated, I'm declaring myself acting president? Or Lyndon Johnson, in the midst of Kennedy's difficulties, had said, the president's Addison's disease is out of control, I'm declaring myself acting president. Or Harry Truman of course that was just the last year, of Franklin Roosevelt's administration. It creates an impossible situation. Vice presidents are going to be very reluctant to do this because you can imagine how the media would focus on it and say the vice president is trying to overthrow the president. And it involves the cabinet. People appointed by the president, they're going to vote on whether or not the president is incapacitated. And as I mentioned, no medical involvement whatsoever. Maybe by looking at these experiences that have happened in a number of administrations, we would change the 25th Amendment to try to tighten up, to try to improve. I don't think any amendment is going to solve all the problems, but I don't think the 25th really comes close at all.
Bill Wample.
I was going to ask along that same line. It seemed to me your account raises a serious question whether it wouldn't be a good idea to repeal the 25th Amendment. I say that because the amendment has the effect of focusing the possibility, therefore the opportunity, on setting up what I call a regency. You would have had a regency for President Kennedy if the proper invocations had been invoked, you might have had. Now, the difficulty with that is that it not only might have removed effectively from office for some indefinite time President Kennedy, and even though he was a Democrat, I still
some of your best friends.
or you take President Roosevelt from a different political standpoint. Think of the possibility we might have had John Garner as regent president. And as you pointed out, we can't solve the problems. We can think up all sorts of problems, and we can get lawyers to write them. But I suggest if you go back through all the history of disabilities that we might easily be better off without the 25th Amendment.
I think the one thing I think the 25th Amendment does two things. First of all, it does put the problem of disability in a constitutional framework. In other words, it does put the problem, it does give a constitutional notice to the problem. Before 1967, it didn't exist. It just wasn't in the Constitution. And I think that is to the good.
That's my basic difficulty.
Also, it does resolve the problem, the constitutional problem, that one instance, which we've had happen in the past couple of administrations, of when a president is unconscious. The acting president now constitutionally, the vice president constitutionally, can become acting president. Before the 25th Amendment, it was not clear whether or not such a delegation of power was constitutional. So that problem has been corrected. But the other kinds of disabilities, I don't think, have been. So I don't think I would repeal it, because if you were to repeal it, then presidents who underwent surgery, and President Reagan, for example, had two major operations, would not be able to delegate, perhaps not be able to delegate constitutionally, their powers to the vice president. At least now they can.
One or two more questions, Henry Thielbart.
With the intensity of the modern political process, with the very sharp image of the president on television, and the particularly in the nominating process with the intense campaigns, isn't it possible that the type of problem, at least the many of the problems that you approached in your discussion, would come out to it, whereas with this very active candidacy we have, focused by the television, you have in some ways a totally different ball game where the president really wasn't in an active campaign, so far as anything but small groups of people are concerned, or set speeches. I wonder if that, in part, couldn't correct some of these problems.
Well, I don't know. I think it could correct some, and I think it could correct some unfairly. For example, Franklin Roosevelt, when he ran in 1932 and again in 1936, was crippled. He had polio, and it surprises a lot of people today, a lot of students, for example, when you say in class that Franklin Roosevelt never overcame the effects of his polio and was never able to walk. They're surprised because they have seen pictures of Roosevelt seemingly standing at podiums and riding in cars and so on and so forth. And I think the media people were very cooperative. They were told never to take a picture of Roosevelt being carried out of his car, lifted out and put back in and so on and so forth. If Roosevelt fell in a couple of times in the 1936 campaign, for example, Roosevelt was speaking in Georgia and leaned against the podium and the podium collapsed and Roosevelt landed flat on the ground. There was not one picture that appeared, not one account by any newspaper that the president fell. Now, of course, it would be on the nightly news, repeated in slow motion 400 times to make certain that everybody had gotten the motion. But would that be fair? What I'm saying is, should a person like Franklin Roosevelt, who has an illness that doesn't affect his mental capacity, should that person be eliminated because of the media giving attention to this weakness or this inability or whatever word you want to use it, I really don't think that would be desirable. I think that would be very, very bad. Now, whether or not the dangerous illnesses could be weeded out, I really don't know. My feeling is there is more disclosure. The media is much more aggressive than it used to be, but candidates could become that much more aggressive in trying to conceal these things.
We want to thank two people today, Ken Crispell, who roused a lethargic Miller Center staff to get interested in this subject and who wrote this very exciting book. We want to thank also the Hardy Dillard of the Miller Center forums, who has not refuted anything that Ken Crispell has said, but has certainly suggested some approaches to the problem from a political science standpoint along with the medical side. And we hope very much that having thought about this problem to begin with in a commission, we can have at least a few more discussions on the subject with people like our guest, if there are any, who have the same intense interest and professional capacity to study it that Professor Gilbert has. Thank you so very much.